violence and gun death is the leading cause of death for children. That just does not make at all sense to me. And I feel like to most people, I've never heard someone say, I wish there was more gun violence. So why don't we do something about it?
Mia, you're sitting there in your brown sweatshirt. Again, you have survived a shooting in your stomach. How are you physically doing right now? And what are your plans in this last minute we have? School's out now. They've canceled it. They're looking for the gunman. What are you going to do?
Yeah, physically and emotionally, a school shooting takes your whole life and flips it upside down. I'm still healing from my physical injuries, and it will be a process that probably takes my entire life. Every single doctor's appointment, it is something else that has to come up, or even just if I'm getting something checked out that's completely irrelevant to what happened to me, they have to know I was shot in a school shooting. And with these, you know, coming days, I'm going to Massachusetts, and then I'm flying home on Wednesday, which will be great to see my family. And then after winter break, I'm not entirely sure what campus will look like, what things will look like. You know, our student body needs
we have 10 seconds,
support
Mia.
And community more than anyone, more than anything else right now. And I just hope that we can all come together as much as possible.
Mia Tretta, I want to thank you so much for being with us. A junior at Brown University, longtime gun safety advocate. She herself survived a shooting from Saugus High School in Santa Clarita, California. All the best to you. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
On Thursday, December 18th, Oregon's farm worker union, PICUN, is calling for a general strike on the Day Without an Immigrant. This comes after months of increased immigration arrests statewide. A number of other organizations have signed on to support, including the Oregon for All Coalition. PICUN is asking people to stay home from work, to stay home from school, and to refrain from spending any money on Thursday the 18th to support the general strike and Oregon's immigrant community.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, Hollywood icon Rob Reiner is found dead, and his son is arrested for murder.
Portland advocates challenge a police union ballot measure to strip back climate funding.
And Oregon puts its new state energy strategy into action.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 15th, 2025. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Anna Wilcox. Hollywood director Rob Reiner and his wife Michelle Singer Reiner were found dead in their home on Sunday. Their son Nick was booked on murder charges. Reiner, 78, was a popular sitcom actor known for All in the Family and later guest starred on shows like New Girl and The Bear. He directed many beloved films like The Princess Bride, This Is Spinal Tap, A Few Good Men, and When Harry Met Sally, among many others. He also became a force in California and national Democratic politics, championing gay marriage and other causes. Ms. Reiner, 70, was a photographer and later a producer. Their son Nick spoke over the years about his struggles with drug abuse and bouts of houselessness. He worked with his father on a movie, Being Charlie, that was loosely inspired by his early life. The police zeroed in on Nick as a suspect almost immediately. He was arrested Sunday night by Los Angeles police and formally booked shortly after 5 a.m. today. California Governor Gavin Newsom said Rob Reiner would be remembered not only for his films and television, but also, quote, for his extraordinary contribution to humanity, end quote. Donald Trump posted about the murder on social media, claiming the killings were a result of their criticism of him in the past. That post brought forward immediate outrage, even from some fellow Republicans. There was no indication that the couple's political beliefs were linked to their deaths.
Portland progressive advocates file a legal challenge against a ballot measure that would take climate tax dollars to hire more police. The lawsuit concerns a ballot initiative that would redirect a quarter of the funds from the Portland Clean Energy Fund, or PSEF, and send it towards hiring 400 more police officers. PSEF is a first-of-its-kind tax on major retailers that funds climate resiliency projects. The ballot initiative to yank some of those funds away is backed by a wealthy Portland real estate developer and the Portland Police Association, the police union. Advocates from Coalition of Communities of Color, Up Next Action Fund, and Portland for All are challenging the initiative. Their suit says that the ballot title for the initiative doesn't meet the state requirements. They also argue that the ballot initiative is a, quote, constitutionally impermissible attempt to delegate to the Portland City Council the power to unilaterally amend the city charter in the future in violation of the Oregon Constitution, end quote. PSEF has been a success when it comes to bringing in funds. Sometimes it's been one of the few city programs to actually be flush with cash. The previous city council raided the fund to bail out bureaus with big budget holes like the Bureau of Transportation. The plaintiffs said in a statement that the measure would, quote, permanently wrest power from the democratically elected leaders of the Portland City Council to set the budget, and placed outsized authority to set the police budget and priorities into a new commission, a majority of whose members are unelected and unaccountable to voters, end quote. That case is expected in Multnomah County Court this week.
Oregon's new state energy strategy is being put into action by an executive order from Governor Tina Kotek. Advocates for clean energy say the move towards electrification is more sustainable and will keep utility costs lower than with fossil fuels. Isabel Charlet reports.
Oregon Governor Tina Kotek has issued an executive order to advance Oregon's new state energy strategy, a roadmap for achieving the state's climate and energy goals. The order directs agencies to strengthen the clean fuels program, accelerate building and vehicle electrification, and expand energy storage and transmission. Nora Apter of Climate Solutions, who helped draft the strategy, says the order signals Oregon is doubling down on climate and clean energy leadership at a moment when federal leadership is backing away.
What the energy strategy found was Oregon can achieve the energy transition that we've mapped out as a state, and doing so is the cheapest and most resilient option for Oregon households and businesses and communities.
Apter says the state's energy strategy is the culmination of 2 years of work by the Oregon Department of Energy, tribes, local governments, utilities, community organizations, and many others. Joel Eboa of the Oregon Just Transition Alliance notes that climate change's extreme weather disproportionately impacts those with fewer resources, including low-income communities, people of color, and rural residents. He says for them, the energy strategy is a lifeline.
At the end of the day, we want to make sure that folks are able to turn on the heat when it's cold and turn on the AC when it's hot and it not burn a hole in their pocket.
One of the state's biggest bottlenecks around transitioning to clean energy, according to Diane Brandt with Renewable Northwest, isn't just building new renewable energy sources. As the governor's executive order states, Oregon also needs to expand and upgrade its aging electrical grid to ensure reliability. Brandt says it has been decades since the last major infrastructure overhaul.
The energy strategy is requiring us to flex these muscles that have atrophied in order to figure out how we're moving forward.
Brandt says many of the updates to the grid are needed now to make sure Oregonians have access to the power they need, as well as to meet the ballooning demand for power in the long term. Oregon has a goal of achieving an 80% reduction in fossil fuel emissions by 2050 and 100% clean electricity by 2040. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
On Saturday, the Family Preservation Project held their holiday gathering. It's a group for mothers and families of those incarcerated in Oregon, dedicated to building community. KBOO's Anna Wilcox reports.
The Rose City Rollers Derby Rink at Oaks Park was abuzz with laughter, clanking, and singing on Saturday night.
Happy birthday to you.
Dozens of families from the Family Preservation Project, also called FPP, joined a roller derby session for the nonprofit's holiday extravaganza.
For us to all be here, a million miracles.
FPP is a nonprofit that operates out of Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, the only women's prison in the state of Oregon. The goal is to keep mothers connected with their children during incarceration and beyond.
FPP is a holistic program that is really comprehensive. It teaches, it gives you hope while you're in prison, but it also teaches you how to be a human, an adult.
I hope it goes to more prisons because it helped me with visiting my mom and spending time with my mom, but I have a dad that's been also there. I lost the connection with my dad in the years that he was there. The program did help me stay connected with my mom.
Attendees made holiday cards to send to people still inside. Mothers wrapped gifts for their children together in a room to the side of the roller derby rink.
Well, the reason why I was able to parent my children when I got out of prison was because of FPP. They taught me to have confidence in myself when I'd given up on myself. And the reason why I still participate in FPP events 10 years later is because every single time there's an event, it shows a success. And as I've gotten out, and after every event, is more and more and more mothers here. I remember the very first event I came to, there was maybe 20 of us. Now there's a couple hundred people here. And that's just a reflection of the success that FPP has in saving lives and saving families.
Hi, this is Desiree Peppers, and to me, FPP was everything. There was a time period where I didn't even talk to my child for 11 months, but they helped me get through that and get over the fear of loving my child because I learned to love myself, and in turn, it recreated a connection with my daughter. It's been my backbone, and it's helped me heal in so many ways.
It means opportunity, it means growing together as family, that we can get along as moms, we can support each other with other moms. Our kids can know other kids, and especially that kids understand what we went through and we connect because we went through the same thing.
Candace Murphy, FPP class of 2019, says that FPP has been a backbone for her.
They've been there for me when I wasn't there for myself. They helped me with bonding with my children from the inside and out, and I just want to say thank you.
Jessica Katz is the founding director of FPP. She says that fun was the primary purpose of today's event.
Why is this event important? Someone asked me this the other day, and like, why do you do this? It's such chaos, and it's so much work, and I was like, because people who have been policed for their whole lives, like their joy has also been policed. And so this is just for joy. It's just for community. It's just for joy. There's no agenda. We're not trying to raise money. We're not trying to sell anybody anything. But we are trying to offer joy to people for whom it has not been abundant. That's it.
The holiday extravaganza closed with a holiday carol. More information about the Family Preservation Project is found online. For KBOO PM News, this is Anna Wilcox. Navajo Nation leaders have clashed in recent months over who should be the controller, the role tasked with managing the tribe's finances. Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin tried to fire that official, but he's been reaffirmed. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bowles, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. For the last few months, Navajo Nation leaders have been butting heads over who is its official controller, the person responsible for handling the tribe's finances. Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin tried firing that top official. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, that dispute is now over.
Sean McCabe has been reaffirmed as the sole lawful controller through a legally binding stipulation between him and Nigrin, which also orders McCabe to be back paid and covers his attorney fees. Nigrin recently apologized for sending profanity-laced texts leaked by McCabe to council delegates.
I use language that I shouldn't have. In moments of great stress, we do not always act as our best selves. This was one such occasion for me.
The October exchange preceded his sudden termination. Screenshots show Nygren pressured McCabe to unlock his government-issued purchase card, but McCabe told him there's no budget. Nygren reiterates that his agreement with McCabe isn't a compelled admission of any unlawful action or wrongdoing. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
A program that helps voters in indigenous coastal communities use buoys to track weather conditions wrapped up another season this fall. Advocates of the Backyard Buoys program says it increased safety for fishermen in western Alaska and helped hunters in Alaska's Arctic land whales. Alaska Desk reporter Alona Knighton has more.
Several years ago, seven boaters went missing in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region and were never found. The loss motivated residents to find ways to better understand their changing waterways. Nalakuk is an organization that integrates indigenous knowledge into research in the region. The company joined a nationwide initiative called the Backyard Buoys Project and deployed three buoys in the area for the first time this year. Lynn Marie Church is Nalakuk's chief executive officer.
We wanted to understand what was going on in our ocean, in our waterways, especially with the changes in the environment that we've seen over the past 10 years.
Backyard Buoys Project helps indigenous coastal communities in Alaska, as well as the Pacific Northwest and Pacific Islands, support maritime activities. Buoys track wave height, temperature, and barometric pressure in real time. Residents can see that information in an app and decide whether it is safe to travel. Church says that using the Backyard Buoys app has been easy.
When you look at where the locations are, it's not by latitude and longitude, it's by place names. That's how we learn in rural Alaska.
Sean Gleason is the head of research and development at Nalakuk.
We picked locations where people travel for subsistence or daily travel.
The goal was also to spread out those buoys so communities in different parts of the region can use the data.
There's no one community. Everyone's related.
In Alaska's Arctic, the project has been ramping up as well. The Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission facilitated the installment of buoys in six communities this year. Martin Edwardson is the commission's coordinator for the project and is also a whaling co-captain.
I was looking at the app and seeing that the waves weren't too big in the general area where we were headed, so we went out that way and we successfully harvested a whale and brought it back to our community to feed.
The Whaling Commission is now looking for translators to allow users of the Backyard Buoys app see information in their native language. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
And in a previous broadcast, we said the Wounded Knee Massacre was observing its 130th anniversary this December. Actually, it's the 135th anniversary. We apologize for the error. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
You are listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy and an overnight low of 49 degrees. And tomorrow, that rain continues with a high of 58 degrees. Today, in 1973, the American Psychiatric Association voted unanimously to remove homosexuality from its list of psychiatric disorders. The quote of the day is from American author and theorist Bell Hooks, who said, quote, "I will not have my life narrowed down. I will not bow down to somebody else's whim or to someone else's ignorance."
Debates over prosecutorial power, utility oversight, and personal autonomy intensify nationwide as states advance new policies on end-of-life care and teen reproductive access. Communities also confront violence after the Brown University shooting. With those stories and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Letitia James is one of the most corrupt
shameless individuals ever to hold public office.
Homeland Security Advisor Stephen Miller says New York Attorney General Letitia James should be charged with mortgage fraud, even though two grand juries have refused to indict her. Supporters and critics of President Donald Trump both accuse the other side of using the justice system for political retaliation. The White House says it will try again to indict James and former FBI Director James Comey, even though several grand juries have unusually refused to go along. A 24-year-old man is in custody after the deadly shooting at Brown University. Two students were killed and nine wounded during final exams. There have been more than 150 shootings at U.S. schools this year. Officials in Australia say at least 12 people were killed in a mass shooting at a Hanukkah celebration on a Sydney beach. The country has strict gun laws and hasn't had a mass shooting in 3 years. North Carolina conservationists and consumer advocates want to stop a major expansion of nuclear power there. NC warns Jim Warren is one of those on a letter to Governor Josh Stein.
We call on the governor to challenge Duke Energy. If they believe they can build new nuclear again, let's have their investors take the financial risk, put up the money, and quit insisting that power users and tax dollars have to backstop them.
Duke Energy says the state needs diverse energy sources to maintain reliability. But watchdogs say decades of failed nuclear projects have already cost ratepayers billions. Research in Texas says more teens are continuing pregnancies they don't want since the state all but outlawed abortion. Kari White of Resound Research for Reproductive Health says the young people can't get abortion pills by mail if they don't have a credit card, among other issues.
Young people just recognized their pregnancy later and so certainly weren't able to get into an abortion providing facility before embryonic cardiac activity. They also just may have been reluctant to disclose their pregnancy to a family member.
Her team found abortions for Texans under 18 dropped more than a quarter after Senate Bill 8 took effect. The law supporters say it's working as intended. In Illinois, a new act called Debs Law means more options for end-of-life care. Callie Riley of Compassion and Choices says it has a lot of safeguards in it and will give patients more autonomy.
Terminally ill Illinoisans who have prognosis of 6 months or less to live and are capable of making their own medical decisions can request a prescription from their physician that will allow them to peacefully end their suffering.
Illinois is the first of Midwestern states to allow aid in dying. Advocates say that'll stop patients from leaving the state for care, while opponents worry about potential risks to people with depression or disabilities. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hey, how are you?
Traffic deaths now exceed homicide deaths in the U.S., and experts say we need an all-out effort to combat the problem. Suzanne Potter reports from California.
Pedestrian deaths are 20% higher than they were 10 years ago, despite some improvements in the past few years. Families of victims say efforts to address the problem are falling short. According to reporting from KFF Health News, traffic deaths now exceed homicide deaths in cities like L.A. and San Francisco. Chris Edwards lost his wife, Tilly, in June. She was struck and killed while walking to her car on Sunset Boulevard in L.A.
Allegedly, the guy who killed my wife, he has had a DUI since 2017, and his license has been suspended since. And what he's taken away from me is a lifetime that I will never know. I will never be the dad raising her kid. And it just hurts seeing how little our system actually does for justice.
Edwards says the system cuts too many plea deals, allowing repeat offenders back on the road. According to the Pew Research Center, speeding, impaired driving, and distracted driving have all become more common since the pandemic. Adam Snyder with the Governor's Highway Safety Association says there are many ways to tackle this issue.
We need fair enforcement of traffic safety laws to address dangerous driving. We need more infrastructure, more crosswalks and safe crossings. We need more vehicle technology.
Some states are looking into requiring reckless drivers to install speed-limiting technology on their vehicles. Last year, Governor Gavin Newsom vetoed a bill that would have required new cars to include intelligent speed assistance, arguing it would disrupt federal safety assessments. David Harkey, president of the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, testified during a House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee hearing this summer that crash deaths increased almost 30% from 2014 to 2022.
This spike is not a global trend. The U.S. is an outlier. Among 29 high-income countries, we rank at the bottom based on per capita fatality rate, and our rate is more than double the average.
This story was produced with original reporting from Chasida Giles for KFF Health News. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The Young Activist Leadership Program in Spokane, Washington, teaches young people how to organize in their communities to make positive change. This fall's cohort has focused on local elections and helped gain two victories for local schools and parks. Isabel Charlet has the details.
Young people in Spokane are learning how to get involved in community organizing, and they're getting results. This session, the Young Activist Leadership Program, known as YALP, led 20 young people through the ins and outs of local elections. Together, the group made 4,000 phone calls, helping gain a victory for two local initiatives supporting parks and schools. Victoria Tasher graduated from the program and is now one of YALP's youth organizers.
Seeing that, oh, things can change positively, because now that those are passed, those schools are going to get renovations, the parks in their neighborhoods are going to get renovations. And so it's a very nice way to counteract that doomerism that a lot of young people are facing.
YALP is a paid internship program run by the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane that runs for 8 to 10 weeks. Each session has a different focus with the goal of empowering young people to take action around causes they care about. Recent data reveal that many young people continue to face mental health challenges. One 2023 study found 40% of high schoolers experience persistent feelings of hopelessness. Fenrir Close, another youth organizer of YALP, sees making positive change, even if it's small and focused on your immediate community, as an antidote to despair. He recommends finding people who share your values and doing what you can.
Great change doesn't start with the revolution. It starts with grassroots organizing and taking your elderly neighbor some food. It's going to start with having a basis of community that people can fall back on when everything else is falling apart.
YALP is planning another session in the spring, and young people who are interested can learn more on the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane website, pjals.org. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
An online course teaches health professionals about climate change and health, helping providers talk about the problem and how it affects the health of their patients. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Doctors and nurses can help educate patients about the links between climate change and health problems like asthma, heat stress, and Lyme disease. But research shows that many healthcare providers hesitate to raise the topic with their patients. Some feel unqualified to discuss it.
Another issue is just feeling like there's not enough time to talk about climate change.
Ben Fulgencio Turner is with Climate for Health, a program led by the nonprofit EcoAmerica. The group offers a free online course and other resources for healthcare professionals about the links between climate and health, and how to easily bring that information into the conversations they're already having with patients.
The goal of that is to both get over that initial barrier of feeling like this is outside of their lane or they don't know enough, as well as giving a structure and framework for having climate conversations.
For example, talking about the risks of exposure to extreme heat or wildfire smoke can fit right into a conversation about reducing asthma triggers or staying safe during a pregnancy. So his group is helping build a network of doctors and nurses who are better prepared to protect patients in a warming world. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Anna Wilcox and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Brian Bowl, Farah Siddiqui, Suzanne Potter, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Anna Wilcox.
And I'm Terrence Burns. Our KABU programs are made possible by the support of our members. KABU is currently in our end-of-year fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KABU to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gasco. Is the conservation movement being as effective as we can be? That is the central premise, or one of the central premises, in the book Conservation Confidential. And the author of that book is my guest today, Mitch Friedman, founder and executive director of Conservation Northwest, and the author of the aforementioned brand new memoir, Conservation Confidential, A Wild Path to a Less Polarizing and More Effective Activism. Conservation Confidential is a highly engaging story about Mitch's activism journey and a provocative exploration of his philosophies around what effective activism and strategy looks like. I found myself both agreeing and sometimes arguing with those philosophies, which, alongside some great charismatic storytelling, made for a really compelling read. I'm so excited to speak with Mitch today, and I hope you'll let me know what you think of this conversation. The show email is coastrange.